Can you hear me well?
Yeah. Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
If anyone else comes.
Like to say your name so everybody knows everybody?
Gilbert.
Meg. Mary.
Cliff.
Heidi.
Patrick.
Victor.
Jim.
Nelson.
Dave.
Kusuf.
Sabina.
Ram.
Okay, so we stress right from the start, we don't teach you anything here, and we don't tell you anything. All we do is point toward and ask you to look to where we point to see for yourself. And that's very important because no matter what you've been told and what you might believe, there's nothing that anybody can ever give you and there's nothing you can ever get. And what we talk about is not anything new. If you look in all the great spiritual traditions, it's the base of them all. They all work from this base. And that is non-duality, but it's non-dual. In Hinduism, they call it Advaita. Advaita translated means non-duality. And they try to describe non-duality by saying it's one without a second, pointing out there's nothing other than that. Here's the same thing pointed out in Buddhism, different words, and say it's non-conceptual, ever-fresh, presence awareness. And they add to that just this, nothing else. Pointing out that is all there is. In Christianity and a lot of other traditions talking about truth, reality, they call it, or God, if you like to put that label on it. They'll say it's omnipresence, omnipotence, omniscience. They're not talking about three things. They're talking about three aspects of the one. Omnipresence means total presence. Omnipotence means total power. And omniscience means total intelligence. Three aspects of the one, just like steam, water and ice, are three aspects of H2O. So, the base of all these great traditions and all is this non-duality, what we call non-duality, one without a second, only that. And if you look at some of those things we just said, they're pointing out in those statements there's absolutely no duality in non-duality. And we don't realise until you have a look that we're functioning from this dualistic position, that we are separate entities, individuals, persons. But that is not so. When you look into it, another thing we point out, that the false cannot stand up to investigation. And if you investigate some of these beliefs you've had, you'll see they will fall apart under the questioning, because the false cannot stand up to the investigation. So that's why we say here right from the start, whether you know it or not, or realise it or not, that what you're seeking, you already are that. And if you start from that point, you already are, you must realise then that the search itself becomes the problem. Because the search implies there's something you haven't got yet. If you do this meditation, read this book, or do this satsang or whatever, you will become something. And you've got to understand that becoming is not being. Becoming implies a future time. And didn't we point out earlier that omnipresence, when there's no future time, and in the past, time itself is a mental concept. And we'll elaborate on those things a little bit more later on, but that's giving you an idea of what it's all about to start off. And some of you have been coming here quite a while and heard this spiel over and over again, so we're not going to go through it today. So the newbies, try and pick up what you can along the way. If you have some doubts or questions, don't hesitate to ask them. And don't be concerned about what you think others will think about you if you ask that question. That's the problem. A lot of fearful of asking the question, what will they think of me? But remember what we're pointing out, the me or the I, the belief in the separate entity, is not so. It's just a mental concept you have about yourself. And that everything comes related to that dualistic concept. So all our problems are problems of relationship, all relative to. And we point out here that the base that you're pointing to, the conceptual image you have about yourself, the ego, the self-centered, doesn't exist if you look into it. So if you're not relating to anything, where does that leave you? It just leaves you as free as nature. And we call it the natural state. And have a look at this manifestation. You'll see that this manifestation is a dualistic manifestation. And it couldn't be any other way. There would be no manifestation if it didn't vibrate dualistically. Could there be day without night? Silence without sound? Movement without stillness? Winter without summer? There couldn't be. So, that's all this appearance, manifestation, is dualism. And as we pointed out, there's absolutely no duality and non-duality. Who is it?
Susan.
Need to grab a chair. Need to grab a chair. Bring it on.
Okay.
Disguised, Susan.
Bernie was welcome. Who are you?
So, anyway, from that, you can all get involved in it. Tell us what you understand about it, or if you've got any sensation, or you realise something, or you're stuck with something. And get into it. Who wants to kick it off?
I'll kick it off.
Yes,
sir. Bob, it came to me the other day that what we're looking out into is what we're looking out from.
Exactly.
And just the light of consciousness just reveals this space, this aware space, and that's what we are.
Yeah. So it came to you. You didn't have to think it out.
Work
it
out.
There you go. Yes, that's what they call it, space-like awareness, you know. The great perfection is non-conceptual awareness, or space-like awareness, they call it.
So everything appears in this space, and, you know, waking, sleeping, all that. Identified consciousness, a separate self, appears in this space, a body. The space is always there, it's revealed by the light of consciousness. I put it that way.
You put it that way, yeah.
But space is obviously always there, and it's the reality we are.
That's right.
Appear to be.
That's right. So, that, you recognise that's always been so.
And effortless.
Yeah. I call it space-like awareness, another way of putting it, awareness, the natural state. And as you say, it came to you, you didn't have to think it out or work it out. The innate intelligence reveals itself.
So when the innate intelligence, this intelligence, then it's permeated through this space.
Yeah. Now all this manifestation is the content of space. Now does space have any centre? Does it have any circumference? Can you say it starts here or ends there? So it has no shape or no form. It's empty. Pure emptiness. So all this manifestation is the content of space. So space is no thing. And all this content appearing as things coming from space, can something come from nothing?
Obviously not.
You've got to be, don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work that out. So all this manifestation is still the same space, like awareness, appearing, vibrating to different pattern shapes and forms. But the pattern shapes and forms, as you say, are nothing but the space. Appearing is different.
And there's no inner space, outer space, my space. There's just space.
The space. Not even space, because you can't give it any shape or form, where they say it's unceasing. Well, it's unceasing because it never began.
Yeah.
Something that's never begun cannot cease.
And space is not affected by what appears in space.
No. Well, have a look at the outside in nature. You know, I mean, tsunamis, civilizations rise, civilizations fall, you know. Volcanoes, patterns break apart, planets blow up, fall apart and everything like that. But has space ever been affected by anything? Can you take anything away from it? Can you add anything to it? And that is all there is. There's nothing other than that. You must be that also, vibrating and patterning as this particular shape and form, a natural expression of that space-like awareness which we've taken ourselves to be something solid and substantial. And that's why the Sagarata will tell you, don't pretend to be what you're not. And don't refuse to be what you are. We're pretending to be this person, this entity, but we're not that. And we're refusing to be what we are. We are no thing. When I say no thing, people take that to mean a vacuum or a void. It isn't. No thing. All this manifestation are things. The carpet, the chair, this, that, you, me, are all things. Take those labels off, they are no thing. And there's nothing separate from it. So you are that.
So good idea is not to label anything, if possible.
Well, you're going to label things, but the difference is, if you know the truth about it, you know, is the label going to affect you? You're going to believe in it. You can use that word to communicate or say this, that, or that. And when I say, you know, the person, have a look, where did that word person come from? The ancients knew it when they formed these words, and some other language of form came from persona, the mask. Pointing out that we've got this mask of identity on ourselves, a conceptual image. It's just a mask of concepts, ideas. Or another way of looking at it is per meaning through, and sona sound, through a sound, a vibration. And you look at all this manifestation, this sound, it's full of sound. Everything has sound or a voice, if you like. The waves have a sound, the water has a sound, you know. Leaves rustling in the tree, everything has a sound, no particular sound. We have the sound which we formulated labels or words. And we take the label or the word to be the thing. That's one thing we point out, that the word is never the thing. Have a look at that. Can you drink the word water? Say water, water for the rest of your life, but you can never drink the word. It won't quench your thirst. You won't drown and you can't swim in it. The word fire burn your mouth when you speak it. You can't cook white, you can't warm yourself with it. It doesn't burn your mouth when you speak it. So the word is never the thing. And we've learnt all these words and taking the word to be real. So we're ignoring our true nature. We're refusing. When he says don't pretend to be what you're not, we're pretending to be this entity we're not. We're refusing to be what we are. We are no thing. But we all want to be something because we think we give it more substance. And you've been this thing as far back as you can remember or think you have been. And look at all the shit it's got into you, all the trouble, all the psychological problems it's got you into. From relating to that a mental image. If something doesn't fit that image, you're unhappy about it, you're anxious about it, you're fearful about it, all your psychological suffering comes about within the belief in these labels and things.
That really resonates with me, what Victor said. What I'm looking into is what I'm looking out of.
Yes.
But it comes back to a question I'm asking you every few weeks, and that's, you know, this business about, tell me again why emptiness is form and form is emptiness. But there was a connection during the week that I thought, hang on, now I can really put this to Bob. I've always understand form, something, and emptiness as opposites, you know. Oh, that's what I can say to Bob, you know. Then I realise, hang on, Bob says that the mind functions in terms of opposites all the time, you know. So maybe that's what was preventing me from just sort of going along with this emptiness is form and form is emptiness.
Yeah, but you see, do you really see that, though? When emptiness is form, and the form can't be anything other than emptiness.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there an opposite there?
No, no.
They're pointing out it's one and the same thing,
yeah.
Different aspects.
Yeah.
And if what Vic said resonated, see it is too.
Yeah, yeah.
You are that emptiness, that space-like awareness. And realise you've never been anything other than that, though there's been the appearances of it we've taken to believe in and believe around. Yeah.
But with this, we are this cognizing emptiness, we're not the body nor any thought that arises, yet we've taken ourselves to be the body and the thought all the time. Can you talk a bit about time and how, you know, time arises? I mean, it's all presence, as you say, but how does this idea of time arise?
Well, have a look at that. We pointed out continually, you know. If you ask yourself right now, is there a past if I don't think about it? Investigate and see. You pause the thought for a moment, and without a thought, what can you say? Can you say there's a past or a future? You can't. And Shakespeare told you that years ago, and he said nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So past and future. But you'll say, I was in the past. And I'll say, well, try and actually live a moment ago. Any of you in this room, go back and try and live 5 minutes ago, last week, or yesterday. You can't go back and live a moment ago. But you can recall it. And you realise the only actuality you're giving it is when you're recalling it right now. Because nobody can tell me what you thought of even a minute ago now, and it's just recalling, it's already gone. And the same with the future. You can anticipate and imagine what you're going to do when you leave here, but you can't live a moment in the future. And the anticipating and imagining is going on right in this immediacy. So a lot of people say you've got to try and stay in it. I'll say try and get out of it.
Yeah.
Because there's nowhere to go. It's always this immediacy when you look at it closely. And see how we get caught up in the way thinking operates and seemingly divides into past and future, conceptually. So you never ever lived. That's how time seemingly happens. And time, you look at it closely, is duration. For me to get to the end of the room would take duration, which would be time. And for that duration to me, it's got to take place in volume, space. Space is volume. But can you find a centre to space, or a circumference of space, or any point where you can say this is where space begins, or this is where it ends? You realise you can't, so you also see that there is no volume. And when you're trying to, looking into, say, trying to look, what's it, try and point out when now is. Try and find now. If you think this now is a moment of time, can you pinpoint now? Because as you're saying now, it's already ending. And as it's already ending, it's beginning again. So it's a spontaneous activity. All this manifestation is spontaneous. You know? Not time-bound or space-bound at all. So recognising that there is no time, no space, can there be a path? We want a so-called spiritual path. Can there be a path? Not taking place in time or space. Can't be. And can there be a destination? Can there be somewhere to go or get to without time or space? It can't be. Where does that leave you? Have you fallen apart and disappeared in the recognition that it's always the same thing? You haven't. That knowing is still there. So you must be that. We call it knowing. The ing on it's something that's seemingly happening in this immediacy. And then the thought will come up, I know. As soon as you say, I know, you've formed a subject, a knower. This believed in entity is then taken on its objective. I know. And what the know, whatever's going on, I know this or I know that. That's become the object. So knowing is seemingly split up into subject-object, which is dualism. But look at it. Can there be a knower without that knowingness? Intelligence energy. You realise there can't be a knower that's not knowing. Can there be the known without the knowing? There can't be the knower or the known without that knowing. So the knowing is the actuality. What is knowing? Knowing is the same as being. And as I say, they call it in Hinduism, the five factors, Satchitananda, Nama Rupa. Satchitananda is existence, consciousness, bliss. Or being, knowing, loving. Is anybody not being right now? Anybody not knowing? And we all love to be. Anybody want to be out of it right now? No. And the Nama Rupa, that's the name and form, the patterns we put on, the words we've learned, the concept we've got, the form. Formulated a label to put on these things. That's the name and the pattern that's appearing in, which is constantly changing. All this manifestation is transient. That body you're sitting in now is not the same body you walked into this room with. Cells are dying in it right now and being replaced. And it's not the same body you had 20 or 30 years ago. You know that for certain. But it's the same knowing that's suffusing it. And if you're not adding all these concepts onto that knowing, that same pure knowing that's always never been there. Again, that's what we're pointing to, this non-dual essence, one without a second.
So the non-dual essence is ever present, and bodies arise and fall in that, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we think the story's about, or the mind will think the story's about our past and our projected future. There's no story, it's just, it's always now, and it's always been now, and all the stories arise and disappear in the now.
Yeah. Well, that Buddhist statement we made at the start, you know, non-conceptual, ever-fresh presence awareness. Non-conceptual, I haven't got any labels for it. And the ever-fresh means it's spontaneous. Not some past argument, it's the ever-fresh, spontaneous thought that is arising right now. So, there again, in that ever-freshness, you're into the spontaneity of it. Not a conceptual time, it began a moment ago, it'll continue. Now it seems continuous, it's not. It's always ever-fresh. And because it seems continuous, again, we put the label time on it and we go back and try and formulate when it began. We try to go back to the Big Bang, some sizes of it happened at so-and-so. How do they know? They don't know. Try and work it out. What was there before that so-called Big Bang came? Was it? Must have been in space. Can anything you ever conceptualise, postulate or think of that could be outside of space? And going in again, space is no thing.
So birth and death are conceptual events then in a way, aren't they? I remember if it's just ever-presence, then where's birth and where's death?
Yeah, that's right. We'll have a look at that. When did you begin? You'll say, I began at birth, but can anyone actually remember your birth? You can't. You can only go back so far in time. Before that, you don't remember. And look into it a bit further, investigate it. You'll see that same animating life essence, that intelligence energy that formulated your father. Uh-huh. And the same animating life, intelligence energy, the life essence formed your mother, that pattern you call your mother. In the mother, a little microscopic particle, an egg or an ovum formed. You can't even see with the naked eye. And that ovum was suffused with an innate intelligence because it knew what to do. It didn't need to fix it onto the wall of the uterus, or wherever it was. Attached itself to the wall of the uterus. And the same with the sperm, another microscopic particle, you can't see with the naked eye, it was suffused with innate intelligence because it knew what to do. It swam. It has the capacity of swimming to the ocean. And it knew where to swim to. And it knew what to do to penetrate that ocean. And it did that with those two cells coming together. The intelligence energy knew what to do. It doubled that cell, doubled it again, and in that little doubling of the cell, the blueprint that was in there from the James Webb Lab knew to form that little embryo, little fetus. What were you doing about it then? So I better grow a finger or a hand or a lung or a heart. You really had no say in it whatsoever. And you can trace it back beyond that if you want to. It never had any beginning anywhere. Just patterns of form, patterns play around, and patterns, shapes and forms disappear. But it's still the emptiness, the spaciousness. So from that, the little embryo grew into the little child. And you look at a little child now, you'll see that as so. A little child hasn't got any words at that stage, hasn't got any reasoning, hasn't got any discrimination. He's just seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, functioning naturally, spontaneously and effortlessly. It's only at about two and a half when the capacity of reasoning develops that the separation comes about with that reasoning, because he learns words, and that's from his parents. And look at that, every word you've ever spoken or ever likely to speak has been learnt or acquired. There is no word that is your natural state. It's all learned stuff we've added onto. The energy of belief going in and make it seemingly real. And putting that belief in the reality of it, that causes all our psychological problems.
So what's really born is the knowingness. Mm-hmm. Knowingness is what we could say is really born. Knowing.
That knowingness was in that sperm and ovum. It was in the father and the mother. It was in the, in this space like, that's Satchin and Ananda. Being, knowing, loving to be. That being and knowing is that emptiness, cognizing emptiness. It's no thing. But it's not separating. And we couldn't have any words, thoughts, if that capacity of reasoning wasn't in that pattern. So the pattern in which things express through is this body. You couldn't have a mind if you didn't have the body. And the mind, you couldn't have a mind unless it was patterning, shaping and forming in that space like intelligence energy. So these are just vehicles in which this intelligence energy, this space-like awareness, expresses through, pattern shapes and forms through. As I say, the Buddha called it a cognizing emptiness, an emptiness suffused with an innate intelligence, or cognizing, or knowing. And he said emptiness is form, pointing out that this emptiness is just, spontaneous form. And the form, he says, so the emptiness is just like a space also, and it forms into different pattern shapes. And he said the form can be nothing other than the emptiness, even though it's appearing as different, taking on some shape and pattern. If it's pure space, there's no pattern. What can you say about space? It is formless. No form in it whatsoever. And the forms appear in it and the forms disappear in it, because form is emptiness. Doesn't mean to say it's going to change, you're still going to... The difference is, the old scriptural saying is, know the truth will set you free. You're free of the belief of the bondage, all these beliefs we've taken on, that's seemingly real and seemingly held us up. And we use metaphors to point that out. You go down to the ocean, I'll say, get me a bucket of blue water. You'll say, don't be stupid, because you know you'll never get a bucket of blue water out of the ocean. When you go down, it looks blue, it appears to be blue, it seems to be blue. Pull the water out in the bucket, it's clear. But we take on the belief that it is blue. But once you see that and once you recognise, you're not going to lose its appearance of blueness. It's going to lose its belief that it is blue. You know the truth about it. As I say, years ago when people looked out where the sea and the sky met, they were told, don't go out there, you'll fall off the edge of the earth. And people believed that until it was investigated. Who would believe today? Because the earth is not flat, but if you look, get down on the shore and you look out to where the horizon is, it seems as though it's the edge of the earth. Still, it seems to be so. Or the water in the mirage, you drive up to where what was believed to be water on the road in the mirage, it disappears because it never was there, and it seems to be. Go out and see a rainbow, it seems all an arch in the sky, a rainbow with all these colours in it, which you investigate and you see it's nothing but the sun shining through the mist has formed these colours, just like the sun shining through a crystal. You've got a clear crystal. and it'll break up into patterns of light. Appears to be so, but when you investigate it, you see the truth of it, there's no light in the crystal. And that's what we point. You've got to look at these things, investigate it, and see for yourself. But you couldn't possibly be anything other than that life essence I call intelligence energy, for want of a better word. Don't use the term God here, because you can get confused with that term. Purely and simply, we come from different backgrounds. Some of us might be atheist or agnostic. Start talking about God to them, so it's all less crap. Some of them be Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, Jews, Muslims or whatever. You know, start talking about God to them. You know, well, no, that doesn't fit my belief or my understanding. I don't want to borrow it. But I use the term intelligence energy, and you've got to use that. That's just a label too. That's not it. But intelligence, another term for intelligence is knowing. Everybody is knowing right now. The ing on it is something that's happening right now. It's amazing. And the energy, the ing on it gives it something that is happening right in this moment, an activity. And isn't any activity a movement of energy? So that's where I get intelligence energy, the activity of knowing. And isn't that going on with each and every one of you right now? So you must recognise that what's enabling that to happen, if you want to put a label on it, is that pure intelligence energy. And then you might understand the Mahavakya, the great word to put out, thou art that, this is that, I am that, this is that, thou art that, everything is that. So you recognise your true nature, you are that.
The habit pattern for labelling is, well, very strong, I was going to say. It just seems there's a resistance, it seems, to, and look, maybe it's just habit pattern that's all, what's always happening. You know, like I feel quite anxious right now, but I'm labelling it as anxiety because it's, I don't know, it's almost, whether that's just the habit pattern, so then there's not the experiencing of it. Instead, there's the working it out to avoid it or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or
so you're labelling it anxious. How could you label it that?
Just from past.
Yes. What
I've labelled it as in the past.
Yeah, you've experienced that sensation, which we've called anxiety. Another sensation we call fear. So, without that label, what is it fresh in you right now, without a label?
Unpleasant. Unpleasant.
Yeah, but you label.
But that's a label too.
That's a label too. Mm. But when is that sensation, what you call a sensation, happening?
Now.
Yeah. Mm. So, and what is now? Without a label, without putting any label to that sensation.
Well, it's just what is.
Yeah, what
it's
is.
Just what's there.
Exactly, what is all, put a label on it, just presence awareness. It's happening presently, and there's an awareness or a knowing of it, and you don't put the name and form on it. That's the existence consciousness, the nama rupa, is left off. So, seeing it as it is right now, ever fresh, present aware, spontaneous, how long is it going to stay if you're not fixating on it, trying to alter it, modify it or correct it, trying to change it?
Mm.
Left as, have a look, where are yesterday's thoughts now? They're gone. Mm. Where are thoughts about an hour ago? Gone. So you realise that thought doesn't last forever. Unless it's fixated on, deliberately kept there.
Mm.
So realise that this so-called anxiety, what's there, then without giving it a label, seeing it fresh in you, you've got to look at it in a different light, see it in a different way.
Mm.
And you might find something interesting in it, or some revelation, or some insight, or something.
Mm.
Can we turn the heater off, Bob? It's getting quite warm in here.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah, lovely on it. Getting cooked.
So when Nisargadatta says, you know, thinking is going on, it's, you know, when you pause a thought or, you know, what's wrong with right now, unless you think about it, there has to be a pause and thinking stops, but then it will always resume because that's what happens. I read somewhere the other day and he was saying about thinking's always happening but there's holes in it. I'm sure that's what it said.
Who said that?
Nisargadatta. Do you know that one?
No, but thinking with the holes, it'll be there are always gaps in thinking.
Mm. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Thinking, as you say, will always be going on.
Mm.
But what's wrong with it unless you're labelled it to, could put point to it at, with put the thinker onto it. I got my foot in the word. So thinking is happening just the same as seeing. Seeing is always happening too.
Mm-hmm.
But you say, I see. As soon as you say, I see, you're formed a seer, a subject. That's the division, a seeming subject. And then what you see, the chair, the table, become the object. So you've divided the seeing into subject and object. There couldn't be a subject, a seer, without seeing. There couldn't be the object, the seen, without seeing. So the same as thinking. Couldn't be a thinker without the thinking. Couldn't be the thought without the thinking. So does it matter if it is going on if you're not putting some shape and form on the thinker? So the thinker and the thought are just labels. Or but thinking hasn't been divided. Seeing hasn't been divided. None of it's been divided, actually. Only conception by thoughts or labels. And the thoughts and labels, as we said before, are words which we've learnt or acquired.
So the label thinking is problematic too.
Is it?
In a way. Well, isn't that a label?
It's a label.
I mean, I get what you're saying to get to the duality bit. But even, you know, thinking is going on, is still labelling the process.
You don't have to label it thinking.
No, that's what I mean.
Just a spontaneous emanation.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, but if you call, you know, label it thinking, and you know that what thinking is, it's not something that's happening separate and apart from the spontaneous functioning.
Mm.
Just a label you put on. Just the same, the seeing is already going. You're not putting the label on, I see all the time, are you?
No.
But has that seeing stopped?
No.
So all of this really in a practical sense of just, I mean, the sort of almost interesting elaborations of, you know, the primary sort of, task you set somebody who comes along here, and that is to sort of examine to see who's the me that's the thinker, that's the seer, that's the thing. And you have a profound, if you actually just do it rather than it sort of being a conceptual discussion point, you are profoundly effective because you suddenly realise you're not who you thought you were, and you never ever were, you know, you never ever were, and
never ever will be.
And never ever will be, you know. It's quite profound, and it's quite a huge shock. Yeah. And then everything else sort of is interesting and sometimes important, you know, to sort of consider the elaborations of it. But that's the primary thing, you know. I am not the seer. I'm not the thinker. I'm not. There's no me in here that's sort of got any substance or independent reality that thinks these thoughts.
Exactly, and that's why we go over it again and again and again, because when the reasoning started, and you were told you were, you know, you were a little boy or a little so-and-so, and had a belief in that idea, that you're in the separate entity, you didn't just hear it once. That was reinforced day in, day out, not only by you, by your schools and the society, your whole nation, every day, and you yourself, you're taking on the idea and constantly reinforcing it ourselves every day. And you know, you hear it, and something will resonate, or ring a bell, as we say with it. You remember there's something there, and it might, you'll say, this is too hard, or I don't want to go this way, I'm going to lose my identity and all this, and don't come back. Or you might get the taste of it, and something will bring you back to hear more and more and more, and you keep hearing it until one day it dawns on you, as Victor was saying, you are that space, that emptiness, that's all you ever were, no thing.
Because, I mean, the other thing is sort of apparently, because we're just talking about time, you know, I might have first heard this almost a decade ago, and then, you know, I think I first related, you know, when I came back the second time, I got what you said, and it shocked me. I was deeply shocked, and then I came back in, I thought, I've got it, you know, and then, of course, you go out into the outside world, and then you sort of get frustrated with yourself because you're not. You're not this, that, or the other, but then, you know, who's getting frustrated and so on. But even now, apparently, I get lost in the identity. But it's never, ever been the same.
That's understandable, because you go out there, 99.9% of the world are functioning with that belief in a separate entity. It's been put on you all your life, you know. So. And you hear this, and people say, oh, I heard when I was all right, and went outside, and I got hooked and caught in it again. Well, naturally, they can drag you back into it. They're not intentionally, but that's the way the world is functioning, 99.9%, intentionally drag you back into it. You keep recognising this, coming back where you hear this, or read about it, or look into it, investigate yourself, and you're going to recognise where they're coming from all the time, from a reference point, a self-centre, or an ego. Instead of them dragging you in, you'll drag them out of it, because somebody will come along and see something about you, or recognise, or resonate. There's something that's going on there. And they'll approach and say, what's going on here, or here at somewhere, and they'll give you the opening, and you'll be able to talk about it to them slowly. Instead of you going out to the world will come to you. And that happened in the Sargadatta's case. You see, and I'm sitting in a little slum room in Bombay, there'd be thousands of people go past his door every day. He wouldn't have a clue he was there or what he was. Yet just by sitting in that room, people from all points of the world would find their way to him somehow or other, from all over the place. And wonder how it happened. There's no time into it, or no distance, or anything at all. And after a while, there you recognise where everybody's come from. It puts you in the box seat anyway, because you know where everybody's coming. They come from a reference point or a self-centre. So, you know, you don't have to take on board what they're saying or what they're doing. We'll go through to the keeper, you know, we'll go around it, over it, above it. But as I say, the old scriptural saying is, 1,000 shall fall on your left hand, 10,000 on your right, but it will not come nigh thy dwelling place. Not come nigh thy dwelling place. And, you know, pointing out, it won't affect you, it won't hit you. And you know, the world's still seeming pretty chaotic to me if I look at what's going on. But I don't get involved in it. Most of the little bit that comes here can be handled quite easily. Yet all that psychological suffering went on for years and years and years. The anxiety, the stress, the guilt, the shame, remorse, the depression, unhappiness. I was rotten with all these things. You know.
The flip side of that is that, this is, you know, the biblical term, this is awake, where we're awake and have our being. I mean, driving back into the world again is a sort of big challenge, isn't it? And to remain sort of as much as possible, seemingly, but to remain calm between the years, because there's no entity here that needs to be defended.
So really there's no entity there, and there's no world, really. The world is just a vibrating pattern of energy also. So there's an equilibrium. Nothing is better than anything else, or worse than anything else. Vic said there's no inside, no outside, no higher, no lower. Everything is just as it is. What is means it's unaltered, unmodified, uncorrected. Leave it as it is. And the alteration, modification is necessary, well, it's spontaneously happen. As you know, life continually changing, things like that. But, like, you know, the river, you know, you pull a bucket of water out of the river and it becomes stagnant and dead. And what's happening to the river? It's still flowing on spontaneously and naturally. It's going over sandy banks, through ravines, through forests, through rapids and all the rest of it goes on. But it's still only the water, but the water you've got in the bucket is dead. We get some conceptual idea or image of what we are, we want to hang on to that. And life itself flows continually. It leaves us behind. And then we get anxious or fearful trying to catch up with it or trying to reinvent it or do this and that. And all that psychological crap goes on again. But leave it as it is and it'll resolve itself. And it does, whether we won't like it or not.
It is, as Jim says, it is easy to get caught up in it. Like, I'm just thinking, you know, 99% of the world is coming from that self-centre, and you can be with someone who's well-meaning and they go, you should do this and you should do that, and you start nodding your head and you think, oh, maybe I should do this and do that. But as soon as you start going there, you've left the reality. But, you've got to continually, well, I don't know, there's no you that's got to continually...
Well,
see it for what it is, actually.
Well, the other way of looking at it, investigate again. And in that investigation, you realise, you know, you've been looking for 10, 20, 30 years or what, and searched hard, and you've never got the answer there. And you look at what we say here, you'll never find the answer in the mind. Because the nature of the mind is to vibrate. It's always vibrating in the interrelated opposites, good, bad, pleasant, painful, happy, sad, loving, hating. So, and it keeps going on like that. So it's always going to divide dualistically. So we can never find non-duality from duality, because duality is a fiction. So when you realise that you weren't going to find the answer in the mind, what would you do? You'd naturally ask yourself, well, what way is there outside of the mind? And you look and realise the only way outside of the mind is full stop. If I pause a thought, get that in the very instant you pause a thought, what can you say about it? You can't say anything at all about it. So you must realise in that moment you're out of the mind, you're beyond the mind. Because with the pausation of the thought, it's not the finish of it. It's not the end of it. Because the seeing, hearing, breathing, tasting, touching, smelling, all that functioning is going on. But thinking is stopped for a moment. So you must realise in that moment I'm prior to the thought, I'm beyond the thought. So there is something that beyond thinking, and under which thinking appears in patterns, shapes and forms and disappears in. But that which it appears in, is still the base is still there, because that the next thought that comes up must be on that base that was there when thought had stopped. If you were the thought, as we believe it, the thought had disappeared, that would be the end of you, but it's not. You know, they're still seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. All these things still going on. Thought has stopped, but the functioning is still going.
So I love that. I always think what comes up for me now is, what's wrong with right now if you're not thinking about it? There's the way of pausing that thought and then seeing, well, hey, without any thought at all, it's always just as is.
Yeah. But you've got to realise that thought's still going to appear.
Yeah.
You know, the sea still appears to be blue, even though it's been recognised.
Sure.
It's not there.
Yeah.
So thinking is understood for what it is, you know. You're not going to invest it with a belief.
Well, this might be unpleasant thoughts or something, even though they pause for a while or something, but they'll still come back, but you can see them from another point of view then, that you're not in them, so to speak.
Yeah.
You're not contained by the thought.
This word investigation, I wish it was as simple as we all make out, you know, just investigate it. There are moments when I'm sort of lying in bed in the morning, often just check, it's nice to check things out, and I can see sometimes that the thought that's arisen, I had no choice about it. It's as clear as ever, and since I have no choice about it, it's very clear that there is no one there, and there's a lovely spaciousness and... whereas 10 minutes later, even just 10 minutes later, I realise that the thought, I have no choice about it. But just saying that, or just recognizing or remembering, it doesn't do the same thing. You know, it's just it's as though I have to wriggle back into it now, you know. And there's all, it's not some, the word investigation, oh, that's all you know, it's there's a lot of messing around with it. Yeah.
Well, got the gist of it, what it means, don't even use that word.
Sure. Well, I don't, Bob.
But in recognising what happened, then naturally intelligence is going to naturally look into this, what the thought is, and see, is this the same as what I was saying before, or is this false too? So the investigation will go on by itself like everything else does. And they don't even call that word, you have a look at it.
Yeah.
This whole thing with the thinker and who is thinking the thoughts and all that sort of stuff, I mean, the investigation is really simple. It's a simple question of asking, what is my next thought going to be? Do I know what my next thought is going to be? Anyone can do that. You can do that right now, and you can see that for yourself. But there is no way anyone can predict what your next thought's going to be. Thoughts just arise spontaneously and disappear spontaneously. And the whole notion of a thinker is also another thought that arises spontaneously and disappears. So there is no thinker of a thought, and there is no chooser of a thought. Thoughts just arise, appear, and play around and go and disappear. And that's a really simple...
And sometimes that is quite shocking, and other times it's just so bloody blasé,
The thing to recognise is that the mind is time. It's pointed out that the mind is time. The mind can never arrive at the timeless. The awareness, the naked awareness is timeless. It doesn't have a beginning or an end. So all of this trying to get to it is just not going to work. As Bob says, you've got to start from the fact that you are already there. And then recognise that if you start anywhere else, as if there is a start, you start with a concept. And that can only take you in the mind in some direction, into imaginary dimensions other than this or whatever. And they're all mind content, but the mind is time. So the great perfection is non-conceptual awareness. You can't have any concepts about that are going to amount to anything that is anything remotely like non-conceptual awareness. It's a direct pointer. Cognizing emptiness. What if the truth is, the absolute truth is that you are that emptiness? Tell me about your suffering. Tell me about your story. There isn't one. It's so obvious, simple, but we seem to insist on being somebody, something.
When you say mind is time, you've got to realise also that time is mind. If mind is time, time must be also mind. So you cancel them both out again, time and mind. Because we say the answer is not in the mind. So that points out that the answer is not in time. So no. Realise, pause the thought, you see that you are beyond mind or prior to mind. You must be in that immediacy, you must also be prior to time also. So must be left in with this word presence. And look at that also, pre-sense. Before any senses are labelled as such. There's no senses, no labelling going on, it's pre-sense. It's this immediacy, it's right now. What is wrong with right now in that pre-sense? Can anybody tell me? So you all must be that already. we'll look into this thing called ego, which is the cause of all our problems. Selfishness, self-centeredness, self will run wild. That we think is the problem. That's a statement in the big book. And it says, above all, we must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Not the booze or the drugs or anything else that kills you. It's the self-centeredness is the problem. Now, how does that ego come about? Well, a little child, as I say, before the capacity of reasoning develops in about two and a half, he's got no idea he's separate entity. He's just functioning naturally and spontaneously. He's like something he's attracted to it. He doesn't like it, he'll push it away. If he's unhappy, he'll howl. If he's happy, he'll gurgle, you know. It's just all a spontaneous, natural function. At two and a half, the capacity of reasoning develops, and that's a useful capacity that the human forms have. And it's a capacity that other animals, birds, insects don't have to that extent. But they have other capacities that we don't have. A bird has a capacity of eyesight that's much better than yours or mine. It has the capacity of flying. We don't have that natural capacity or the eyesight. But through the capacity of reason, which is a useful capacity, we've learned to build glasses, binoculars, or telescopes, things like that, that enable us to see much better. Also, to build planes, helicopters and other things that enable us to fly. So this capacity of reason, very useful capacity, because computers, televisions, all these other inventions come about through the capacity of reasoning. But a dog has a capacity of smelling, a sense of smell that's much better than yours or mine, aren't they? Tigers, leopards and animals like that, their stripes, spots in their fur, make a natural camouflage. You think the little tiger cub sits out, I better grow a few stripes in my fur, otherwise I won't be able to catch any prey. Or the leopard says, if I get up in the tree and all those spots mingling with the leaves and that will give me a natural camouflage. Or the chameleon, it can change colour and all these things. All in this natural function, the pure intelligence entity. All naturally and spontaneously doing it. They don't do anything about any of these things. It just happens naturally and spontaneously because their innate intelligence knows what is necessary for that to pattern to shape and form or express the way it does. Look at these human forms of that intelligence as it expresses through pattern, shapes and forms. But all these pattern, shapes and forms are the vehicle through which this intelligence functions. Pattern, shapes and forms are just the vehicle. And in this functioning body, thoughts arise. They're just a vehicle for expression. We say mind, but is there such a thing as mind? Can anyone show me a mind? Mind's just expressing through what we call brain and other parts, but they're the instruments of expression, just the eyesight, the seeing. Eye is the instrument of seeing, ear is the instrument of hearing. The brain is the instrument of thinking. So doing whatever it does, I'm forgetting. So, but could this body utilise those instruments? If what was utilising the body? You realise it must be that same innate intelligence as patterning function in this universe, has formed this pattern to express through, experience through, just the same as it forms the tiger, the leopard, the dog, anything else. Patterns for which this innate intelligence expresses, pattern shapes and forms. And it couldn't do any of those things if these patterns weren't here. But all they are is patterns. They have no substance or independent nature. They can't stand on their own. So with the capacity of reasoning, a little child learns words from his parents. As I pointed out before, every word you've ever spoken has been learnt or acquired. And he starts functioning, fussing around, his parents fussing around, saying, "You're little Johnny, you're a good little boy," this, that and the other. And he starts to reason, "I am little Johnny," when he starts to learn words. He learns words like "I," "me," this, that and the other, from his parents. And with that reasoning, he starts, "I am little Johnny," "well, this little Johnny is me," two words he's learnt, now he can attend. But he reasons that out there, where he's seeing everything as it was, he says, "That's not me, that's not I." So when that comes up, he feels separate from it. And with the sense of separation comes insecurity and vulnerability. That's when the search starts. From then on, we're looking to become secure or whole because we've taken on the belief, without questioning it, that we are separate. And we don't like to be the separate. Because with that sense of separation comes insecurity and vulnerability. The little child in there feels separate and vulnerable. What happened in the old days? Wouldn't. And the little child's got a warm, loving family. He feels much more secure with that warm and loving family, much happier. What did families do in the old days? Wouldn't they form into tribes? Because the bigger and stronger my tribe, the more secure, the less vulnerable I'm going to be. And isn't that going on today? Nations form into nations. Nations go to war with that nation. Purely and simply because they feel insecure and vulnerable. And to add something onto it, another family or a tribe or a nation, or a good company or a good job or whatever, or more wealth, they'll feel much more secure, less vulnerable. All adding, accumulating, amassing, which we encouraged to do by our school, society, our nations. Acquire, amass, accumulate, add to, whatever we can to make us feel whole. Nobody's not ever realizing they weren't separate in the first place and turn around and have a look at that, investigate that. But down through the ages there have always been a few that have done that. That's what carries this message on and on and on. And as you pick it up here, we'll be able to carry it on. Like it's always been carried on.
So that sense of vulnerability is born in the idea of me and not me.
Yes.
And everyone's afraid of dying, it seems. This fear of death is that idea born with vulnerability, which is attitude throughout your life. And this huge thing called death that everyone's afraid of. But actually it's based on an idea of being separate, which is not actually true.
Yeah. Yes, that's what was born. It was only this idea of me that was born. You can't remember your birth, so it doesn't come onto the capacity of reasoning. And when it comes upon you, you've got this conceptual image. And that's why Banky, the Zen monk in the 16th century, says everything is perfectly resolved in the unborn. He called it unborn mind. The Buddhists call it unborn mind. That's what we're. Everything is perfectly resolved in unborn. Look out there in nature. And say that nature resolves itself. Mightn't be the way we think it should or the way we'd like it to, but everything's resolved. Civilizations have arisen, civilizations fall. Global warming's happened before, ice ages have happened. All sorts of things have happened in this manifestation. To us, it might feel terribly chaotic and horrible, but in nature itself, it's going along perfectly just as it is.
And conversely, Bob, when people commit suicide, it's really a desire to kill that sense of self. It's the sense of self that they want to go, that they want dead.
Exactly.
You can't kill life. Life, how can you kill life? Life is always present. It's that sense of me, that miserable self-centre that's caused so much problem they want to get rid of. That's what drives.
Mm. And the same with the fear of death is the fear of the loss of the ego.
Yeah.
The ego,
yeah.
Yes, we get a conceptual image of what conceptual image of what death is, and naturally we don't want to know. Yeah. Noticing.
That's Paul's sort of said. Well, that was Paul's thing, wasn't it? You die to yourself each day.
Yeah, that's right.
And St. Francis tells us the same thing. He says, it's only by dying I can have eternal life. You're not talking about gargling every day. You're talking about dying to that sense of self.
And the Sagadatta says, I'm dead already.
Well, when you're with Maharaj, he said he fired a lot of arrows at you. Which arrow hit the mark? What was it that you realised? This whole thing, what was this one?
Showing, Bob. Pull out the bow.
Yeah. a matter of a natural recognition. We've already cognized it, we've already had taste of it, that's the cognizing.
Okay.
But something, you know, you might have obscured or thought over, something, you hear something that resonates and you recognize it. Rings a bell, something, you hear something here that's, you all recognize it, you've already had taste of this throughout your life. When things have seemingly fallen into place quite effortlessly and naturally. And then it seemingly gets obscured again with the thoughts, but see that the obscuration is like a cloud that seemingly covers the sun. Go outside in a cloudy day, would you say the sun's not in the sky? You know, you can't say that, because no matter how dark the cloud is, there's always enough light getting around it to enable you to see the cloud. If it was total darkness, you wouldn't know there was a cloud there. And you investigate that and have a look, what forms the cloud? If you ask, what forms the cloud? You realise the sun itself forms the cloud. Now the sun doesn't know anything about the cloud. It doesn't set out to form a cloud. It's self-shining, shines of itself. When we say here, self-shining presence awareness, we're meaning the same thing. We don't have to start anything up. Like the sun doesn't have to start up. It's just naturally shining with itself. In that self-shining, it's what does it do? Its heat evaporates water. And in that water evaporation, it rises and condenses again as it gets up going. In the condensation, it forms a cloud, which is seemingly obscured the cloud, the sun. And that's what happens. These thoughts arise through that natural functioning intelligence energy. It warms up what it does and doesn't have it. Does that and then it starts the cloud of thoughts to form. And we think we've lost it or obscured it. If the, in the recognition that the sun has never left the sky, it's always self-shining, and you are that self-shining presence awareness itself, doesn't matter what seeming thoughts, feelings or emotions are going to come up and seemingly obscure in it, if you know the truth. The sun has never stopped its self-shining. And then this radiation and heat, it sends out the radiation that can cause a wind to stir or something like that, it'll blow away the cloud and bring it down as rain. Other clouds, shape and form. The cloud is nothing of itself, it has nothing it can do of itself. It happens through other situations, through that natural functioning intelligence energy. The same with here, when you recognise that this essence that you believe yourself to be has no substance or any independent nature. As I say, the little child is functioning spontaneously and naturally. When he learns words, he starts to lose that spontaneity because he thinks now. He is this body-mind entity, and he knows more than what the natural intelligence does. He loses sight of the intelligence. So he starts to lose his spontaneity and relates it to the mere memory. Oh, I like this, it's good enough. Where everything is happening spontaneously and naturally, now he relates it to the mere memory. And I don't like that, or I do like that. If he does like something, and everything in this manifestation is a dualistic manifestation. Couldn't be day without night, silence without sound, and it's constantly changing, it's constantly transcending. So we, in our belief, we don't want the good things to go. We want to say the good, happy and loving all the time. Realising it's transient, it's going to change all much of life. You know, the things you've loved and not, you know, after a while they become very ordinary, very normal, very boring, or they die, they move on, or they leave you. And even the body is changing, transient, constantly moving. And so that's it. There's constant change going on. But we don't want it to change. We think we know better, we want to keep it there. We've got to be like this all the time. So what do? We resist it. And trying to keep it there, we resist it. And you've got to realise, any resistance, you're in conflict. If you're resisting something, you're in conflict with it. You're not going with the flow. And any conflict you win is disease. If you're in this conflict, this unhappiness, depression, anxiety, stress, that's dis-ease, uneasiness, or dis-ease. So the same thing happens if something I don't like comes up. I don't like this, immediately the resistance comes about, immediate conflict, immediate disease. So you have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work that out. All your psychological suffering comes about because this constant resistance is going on in your body.
What constitutes resistance?
Pardon?
What constitutes resistance?
The belief that you're relating it to this me. Belief that, you know, you want to change it, alter my... You're relating to a fictitious me. The resistance, you know, if you're resisting and struggle with it, it becomes anxiety, fear, guilt, shame, remorse. Or whatever else defects come about. All based on the resisting, relating. All problems are problems for relationship, relative to this me of memory. And there is no relationship in non-duality. Relationship is a fiction. No duality in non-duality. So we're constantly relating to a fictitious entity, and that causes our anxiety, our fear. So all that this psychological problem is what they call karma, cause and effect, relationship. And relativity, relationship, is duality. Me is the cause, this belief in the me is the cause of all my defects. What happens, that's all so-called karma, and what happens if I investigate and see the cause me is a fiction? And ask myself, can there be a cause, or can there be an effect without a cause? And you realise there can't be an effect without a cause. So what's this psychological suffering going to relate to then? Been relating to a false me, a false belief, there's nothing to relate it to. What happens? It must be just like in nature. It's going to move on. It's not fixated on and clung to, trying to be altered, modified, or it. It's free to move on, like it does in nature. Nature is a dualistic manifestation, but nature hasn't formed an ego, hasn't formed a reference point. So day never in conflict with night. Silence is not in conflict with sound. Winter's not in conflict with summer. Each take their turn and move on. With this conflict that's going on, we resist it and keep it there, seemingly keep it there with that belief, energy of belief going into it, until it causes all this psychological crap. But it doesn't have to be that way. That's what we point out. Nobody has to be locked into all this psychological stuff. People in here, like I say, I was full of it years ago, but it hasn't been there for many years now. People in this room will tell you the same thing. You investigate it and say it doesn't have to be this. It's got no substance or any independent nature. That conceptual image or me. You look at it this way. You're seeing right now and you're hearing right now. Does your eye tell you I see? My eye doesn't say look at this, look at that. The seeing is happening and it's translated by the thought. I see. I see this inside. The same with the ear. Hearing is happening through the ear. The ear is not saying listen to this or listen to that. The thought, now when the thought I see comes up, remember it's not just a bare thought anymore. What we've related to the thought is me, Bob, the Australian, the good fellow that's done this, done that, low self-esteem, fearful, anxious. This conceptual image, because I've taken a belief and never questioned, now I think that me is seeing, that me is hearing. But if we look into it, can the thought I see, actually see? And you realise, close your eyes, look around the room, see what you can see with a thought. You see that, you know, a thought cannot see. And the same with the thought I hear this other. But can the thought I hear, remember, again, it's related to me, Bob, the Australian, the good fellow, now thinks it has the capacity of seeing, hearing, but can the thought I hear, I see, can't see, the thought I hear, can't hear, the thought I am aware can't be your awareness. The thought I choose is not the choice maker. We think we choose our thoughts, but who would have an unhappy or miserable thought if he could choose it? So this thought-up entity has no power or any independent nature to do anything of itself. It's only the belief going in it that gives that seeming, gives itself some seeming power, but it's actually got no power. Look at that. How many thoughts does a corpse have? You know, that life essence is not animating and patterning expressing through that body. It's a corpse. It can't have any thoughts. It can't hear, it can't see, it can't be aware, it can't choose. It hasn't got any substance or any independent nature. So it's that life essence itself that's doing the living. Take that out of the body and just a corpse. Just like a computer's got all that information on it. you know, punch the keys, type something in, you get all sorts of information up. But if the power's not turned on, what information are you going to get? You're not going to get a damn word, nothing at all. So without that animating life essence, that intelligence energy, how are you going to feel? How are you going to be unhappy, miserable, or anything else at all? Or good, feeling joyful, or anything without that life essence? So you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work that out. It must be this life essence that's enabled this living to happen, the functioning to go on, seeing, hearing, tasting, sound, the joy, the happiness, the sadness, everything is being expressed through that life essence, the intelligence energy. And that life essence has no birth or no death, as we pointed out before. It's no beginning, no end. It's got no substance or no independent nature. It's just the totality of being. Again, brings you back to what you are. You are that, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or leave it. You're going to say it's all bullshit or whatever, say about it, you're still that. Why not take delivery of it and recognise and be what you are, as Nisargadatta says. We pretend to be, don't pretend to be what you're not, and don't refuse to be what you are. We pretend to be this entity, we're not. We're wearing this mask of identity, we're not, we never were. And we refuse to be what you are. What you are is the no thing, the pure intelligence energy. Nobody wants to be what seemingly is no thing. But that no thing is the same intelligence energy that functions this manifestation, the whole of it. It hasn't got any separation or any division in it anywhere at all.
The thing with resistance, Bob, what my experience is, like something happens in life and I don't like it, and I think that it's the, you know, that I'm me that doesn't like it, which is a thought, and the thought's fighting another thought that, you know, or you know, could be a thought even, I don't like that thought, I want to get rid of it. And the two thoughts about an I, and I, you know, I know this stuff, I, you know, that I don't do the seeing and I don't do the hearing, done that investigation. But still, there's something there that thinks that life should have gone another way or should be another way.
Yeah.
And that's another way for me, really, when I come to it. It's really a position I've taken and held on to in some way as a thought. And it's become a belief that it should be another way. Until I really let go of that belief, the resistance tends to just keep coming up all the time. Or until I see that the belief is not, it's just another thought really, the belief, and I see it as being, having the same value as any other thought.
Yeah. Did you think that thought?
No.
Well, that's coming from the intelligence energy also, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And leave it as it is. You know, tell you to move away or do anything, you know, the appropriate thought will come up and either take you away from it or keep you there or whatever it does, you know. It'll express through thought as thought, a lot of it. But there's no thinker of that thought and leave it as it is.
Yeah, whatever of resistance, it's always changed anyway. Yeah. Looking back at the history of all the things that have caused me so-called suffering.
And it resolves itself one way or another, doesn't it, if left alone. Doesn't mean to say that thoughts won't come up. Thoughts will come up hard and fast, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, if it's coming intensely and fast like that, probably giving you the clue what to do, you know, how to spontaneously respond to it.
That pointer that Bob chucks out at everyone all the time, does the thought I see, there's a thought I hear. I mean, that really, you know, if that is sort of carried out to the end and actually seen, what he's pointing out with that, it completely just demolishes any notion of a separate self. I mean, it's a very basic statement, you know, does a thought I see, or does a thought I hear. But in that statement, what you're actually recognising is that the subject, me, can't do anything. That subject me is just a, you know, you can't separate that from the thought I see. And that so-called me is just, you know, it's purely conceptual. So the actual seeing is just happening, the hearing is just happening. And that whole subject-object duality is just it's an appearance that appears with the thought. So that can you know, you can then take that to any story that appears, any sort of thought or story that appears, still operates in the same way. There's still a seeming subject there, and then there's the object. But the whole thing is just is conceptual.
Yeah. And so the big one is also, you know, there's the thought I do, you know, when I realise that there's no doer, and then, you know, obviously it's like I should have done, or, you know, stuff like that, you realise there's no should have done, there's no one who could have done differently, it is just as it is.
Everything is perfect, just as it is. Even when it seems not perfect, it's perfect.
And then this awareness, we could put the label awareness on. But is anybody in this room unaware right now? If you're not unaware, you must be aware. So you already are there. And as Ram was just saying, the thought, look at that, you'd have to say, I am aware all through this meeting. But don't you recognise or realise that awareness was there, whether you're thinking about it or not? But then when you think about it, you form a concept about it and get lost in the concept. When you start, you know, giving awareness on it, you make a concept of it, it becomes the object. And for the object to be there, there's got to be a subject. And you're going back to the me again, being the subject, recognising the object. But, and the recognition that it hasn't at any time been unawareness there. There's always the awareness there. You haven't split it up into subject on it.
Say, Bob, that's fully evident when you see a baby or a puppy before it has got its name and, you know, gone into the so-called world. That's just that pure awareness there. And there's a joy that's with that.
Yes. Yeah. There's a functioning equilibrium there. There's no better, no worse, no higher, no lower, no past, no future. They're all equal. Same thing when we recognise all these thoughts and concepts we have. The nature of the mind is to vibrate in the opposite, it's either good or bad, pleasant or painful. You see the good and bad as the same essence appearing and expressing. You know, and neither going to be better or worse, and it's free to move on. As I always say, there's no one-ended stick. There's always two ends to the stick. You know, one end might be rough, the other might be smooth, but it's still the one stick. Left as it is, it's still only going to be the one stick. But we try to alter it, modify it, or correct it to make it fit what we think it should be. And that only makes it worse.
I'm interested in the way we talk here. It feels sudden. To wake up or see it or notice it. I'm interested in the gradual. And in my mind, in the past, graduals have felt like path, when I don't think it is. I think both sudden and gradual can be misunderstood as path, but there's ways of being in that.
Where are you measuring gradual and fast from?
Okay.
You've got to have a reference. You're still relating it to a reference point.
Well, it's through the talk about resistance.
Yeah.
And if we have big resistant patterns that just don't disappear like that, there's a being with them which feels more gradual. That's where I'm coming from.
But it's got to be in relation to something. It's got to be. But what if it is just as it is?
Just as it is.
Yeah. If it's what you'd like to label gradual, that's just as it is.
Yeah.
That's ever fresh. In the moment.
Okay.
And it's going to be next thing might be gradual. That's still ever fresh. Spontaneous. Spontaneity hasn't got any beginning or any end. As its beginning, it's already ending. Can't be a path, can't be a destination. This life is spontaneous right now, ever fresh.
Yep.
Put a label on it, gradual. You know. How long is this gradual going to take?
Yeah, well, I'm not convinced here.
Peter?
Yeah.
Don't have to believe that, but question it, see for yourself, you know, recognise it. But that might keep you looking, see through it more.
Yeah. Well, I just want words that speak of that experience as well, because, I don't know, sudden, you know, why don't we just see it?
But
how to be with, you know, when
Patrick,
people actually do have big
Patrick,
pain. Yeah.
Are you seeing right now?
Seeing right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that gradual?
No.
It's immediate.
Okay, true.
But when you put the it on,
it.
You're adding something onto it, seeing it, why can't I see it right now? But the seeing is not gradual, it's immediate.
No, that's true.
The hearing is immediate.
Yeah.
That the content we put on it, and the content is not the reality.
Yeah.
It's adornment. Like you've got a Christmas tree, it's just a tree, but you put the baubles, blah, 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 and you have adorned it with all these baubles and things like that, and makes it seem something much better. If we're not adorning this presence awareness, you know, that's just what it is, presence awareness right now.
Yeah. So being with that. Or just being it.
And you know, it doesn't stop thoughts from coming up, feelings, emotions, recognising as it also, they can be endured because the struggle, the conflict about trying to resist it won't be there. And when, you know, the defects are there, the qualities are there, but we focus on the defects, we miss out on the qualities. The love, the joy, the happiness are there too. But we're not focusing in the defects, trying to do something with them. And they're not bound into this constant resistance. There's a subtle joy that wells up of its own accord.
Yeah.
Sense of well-being, that nothing's wrong.
Yeah.
Well, the defects and the resistance are all just mind stuff anyway.
Yes.
You can just full stop them anyway.
Yeah.
When I hear you answering my time-laden questions or Patrick's time, you know, I just see that you're here to blow all of these concepts out of the water, you know.
Well, look at the word concept. Well, the definition of concept is just a mental construct. What are we doing? Making mental constructs with words, images, ideas of something that has no independent nature whatsoever. It's not anything. You've got to use words again.
That's a point of... Ram was talking about the point of... the point of the... I was just thinking 20 minutes ago when you mentioned nothing has self-nature. That's always something that just gets past all of my conceptualization. It's a, beyond all understanding. It just goes
through. The truth that passes all the
way. Yeah. It's good. And you know, the Buddhists talk about the two sicknesses. One, the belief in a fixed... entity, you know, and the other one is a desire for real objects, you know, and it's that second one that's rather fascinating, and it just deals with that, you know. I'm not having to deal with all these other fixed entities in my life.
We're doing this as a desire. I want something that's related to it, and a desire to get rid of it too. I mean, that's still, they're talking about the two things, but they're creating a third,
which is
a
desire to get a doer, right here.
It's sort of like the word manifestation or manifest implies coming from nothing.
Yeah. That's what they call it, yeah.
All right.
Phenomena and noumenon. The definition of phenomena is that which appears to be. And this universe is a dualistic manifestation. It appears to be. It's a phenomenal universe. The opposite of phenomena is the noumenon, the unmanifest. The definition of noumenon is that which is. So it's the unmanifest which is the reality, because that never changes. But the phenomena is constantly changing.
I mean, it's our nature to tell a story, to conceptualize, and it's functional. It's very, very functional.
Yeah.
It's just the depth. It's the intensity of belief that the. In, you know, me with my story, that's the doer, that's the thinker, that becomes a problem, you know, it's a completely self-made problem, that, you know, causes pain. quintessential definition of, you know, unnecessary pain.
I'm interested too that this state of, well not state, this movement to non-separation or it seems to have a quality of aloneness, which is not lonely. Can you speak to that or say what you think of that statement?
It can express in all patterns any possibility whatsoever, as it does.
Yeah.
All sorts of appearances, possibilities are all expressing in this manifestation constantly. But the essence, the nature of them all, can all be broken down into just an intelligence energy. The shape and form.
I just thought a weird sort of those word things alone could be read as all one.
Yes.
Whether that's a valid.
And you must be that way.
Etymology.
You must be that one, if everything is one. Not you. Okay, thank you.
Well done. Thank you.